These issues didn't exist prior to contact, so there's something fundamentally wrong.
It's this glorification of militarization.
Rooted in all of, you know, the hatred of women and the sexism and the homophobia is, I would have to say, a fundamental lack of willingness on the part of men to become more self-aware, to look at themselves, and to do some work around emotions.
Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News, brought to you by volunteers at Canada's community radio stations.
This episode of Groundwire was produced by volunteers at Kootenai Co-op Radio on Sinike's traditional territory in Nelson, BC.
In this episode, family members, community organizers, and Indigenous leadership reflect on the announcement of the inquiry into missing and murdered Indigenous women, Two-Spirit people, and girls. Also reflections on the December 6th Polytechnique massacre 26 years on, and live coverage of community members protesting arbitrary status checks and racial profiling at Toronto Police Headquarters.
On the Community Radio Report, Francella Fialos produced a documentary for the 16 Days of Activism Against Gender-Based Violence organized by the World Association of Community Broadcasters, or AMARC.
But first, here are the headlines.
Rights!
Rights!
On December 17th, communities around the world marked the International Day to End Violence Against Sex Workers. Events took place in Canadian cities such as Montreal, Vancouver, St. John's, and Toronto. Ting's, a member of the Migrant Sex Workers Project in Toronto, spoke at a rally at Toronto Police Headquarters.
Recently, Swan Vancouver, an organization that works with migrant sex workers, put out a report, and it says that 95% of the respondents who were migrant sex workers said they would never call the police, even, and I quote, if they were facing experienced violence, harassment, abuse, or exploitation. So people, this is 95% of respondents are saying they would never call the police if they faced any of these. So we're not talking about accessible police services here. We know that the police, as with other arms of the state, are constantly there to repress, to criminalize, to persecute, and to push migrant sex workers further underground. So today on the International Day to End Violence Against Sex Workers, here to also assert that migrant sex workers are, they're our family members, they're community members, they're neighbors, they live and work amongst us, they play amongst us, we're part of the community. Migrant sex workers are workers and fundamentally deserve workers' rights. They deserve safe working environments, they deserve dignified ways of living, they deserve to be treated as human beings, as workers. And so today we're here, we're in support of known as Legal Toronto in demanding an end to the practices of racial profiling by the police, an end to the collaboration between Toronto Police and the Canadian Border Services Agency. We also demand an end to the anti-sex trafficking laws that we've been seeing. We don't want to see any more funding of anti-trafficking policing, and those resources should be redirected into community resources that support people, not criminalize and persecute them. We demand labor rights and protections for all migrant sex workers. And we demand a moratorium that migrant sex workers, regardless of their status, should not be detained, should not be threatened with deportation for simply caring about their lives. We demand justice and dignity for all workers, regardless of race, gender, place of birth, or immigration status.
The Little Campbell River is said to be the most productive salmon river in the Lower Mainland relative to its size. A newly formed group called the Friends of Hazelmere Campbell Valley are speaking up about what they believe is a threat to the salmon in the river, as well as to the human population that lives nearby it. Developer GG Metro Holdings has applied to rezone 77 acres of prime agricultural land near the river's banks in Surrey, BC, to light industrial, in order to create a truck park with room for 12,000 rigs, a gas station servicing facilities, truck wash, and massive scale warehousing. Brian Coote spoke about the group's concerns with James Mainguy, a host of the Red Eye Media Collective on Vancouver Co-op Radio.
It is the most productive salmon river of its size in the Lower Mainland, and it's also one of the
if not the only river that is clear of obstacles for spawning fish to return upstream in the lower mainland. And it's been painstakingly restored over the last 59 years by volunteers with the Little Campbell Watershed Society and the Semiahmoo Fish and Game Club. And after all these hours and money and energy being sunk into it, it's just a shame that the city would allow this type of an application to even be considered. Beyond the salmon, of course, we know there are up to 22 threatened or endangered species that reside in the area. There are corridors of old-growth forests, which are extremely rare and hardly found anywhere in the lower mainland anymore. So the threat to the environment is, of course, one of the important issues that the Friends of Hazelmere Campbell Valley has about this application. The Brookswood Aquifer is the water supply for thousands of rural residents of Surrey and Langley in the surrounding area. It's a shallow and unconstrained aquifer, and although I'm not a hydrologist or a hydrogeologist, the ones we have consulted thus far have warned us that there would certainly be carcinogens and heavy metals that would find their way into this aquifer and therefore into the well water supply for residents. And the opinions we have gathered so far is that there is no engineering solution that can make this 100% safe. The technology just simply does not exist.
That's it for the headlines. We'll be right back.
You just heard J. Edward Byrd Reflections on Justice by Vancouver musician and composer Neelamjit Dhillon from his album Komagata Maru.
Now it's time for our feature stories.
Kanarji O'Sullivan interviewed grassroots organizers, family members, and Indigenous leadership about the announcement of the National Inquiry into Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women.
On Tuesday, December 8th, in Gatineau, Quebec, at the Assembly of First Nations, the Liberal leadership announced that the first phase of the inquiry into missing and murdered Indigenous women, girls, and Two-Spirit people would begin. Kanarji O'Sullivan brings us interviews with community organizers, Indigenous leadership, and family members. Kanarji spoke with Viola Thomas, Kamloops band counselor.
Prime Minister Trudeau came on the first day on Tuesday and offered his remarks. And one of the things that I really appreciated about what he said was that the government of Canada has a sacred obligation with Indigenous peoples to ensure that their constitutionally protected rights are honored, and that Indigenous peoples are not an inconvenience. And there was a lot of emotion because we also had Minister Jody Wilson announce the public inquiry on murdered and missing women, and it was very emotional for many BC chiefs on the Leadership Council of British Columbia because, as you may be aware, she was the former vice chief for British Columbia for three terms. And so many of the chiefs honored her for being elected. And it was very, very exciting, very emotional.
Dawn Harvard Lavallee, president of the Native Women's Association of Canada, shared her reflections on the announcement.
We have our inquiry. Got the announcement from the Prime Minister. You know, we had Carolyn Bennett here announcing, you know, that the very first phase, the pre-inquiry consultation with the families, and is literally starting immediately as of tomorrow.
Wow.
And, you know, wanting to make sure that the national inquiry is not seen as a goal in itself, that that is not seen as, you know, now they have dealt with the issue of ending violence. You know, we all know that the recommendations, the conclusions could take years. And we need to start rolling up our sleeves and getting to work right now, and there's a lot of areas we can get working. We recognize we want action now. We don't want to see the government dragging their heels. We don't want to see this take forever, but we need to take a sober second look to make sure we're doing it right, to make sure that we're not causing, you know, further trauma, especially to the families, to those women who have advocated to this for this right from the start, you know, that we cannot barrel forward ahead without them, you know, without even thinking about their being here.
Chief Wayne Christian, co-chairperson of the Shuswap Nation Tribal Council and the chief of Splatson First Nation, was also in attendance at the Assembly of First Nations launch of the inquiry.
The women chiefs and the leaders are really saying, well, you know, it's time, and it's about time, and I think we've really got to pay attention to how we proceed with this and how critical it is to make sure that the murdered and missing women and their families are directly involved in it. Regional Chief Shane Gottfredson has that portfolio, and he's really brought the women organizations, like the Native Women's Association of Canada as part of it, and he's bringing the women along with him in terms of them being the people that are going to be in charge of how this will run. But most importantly, what he's talking about is how do we actually involve, make sure the families are involved in this whole process, as the impact is quite far range. It's children, it's brothers and sisters, moms and fathers, grandparents, that they have to be involved in the actual design of the actual terms of reference for the inquiry.
Elizabeth Hunt provided legal counsel to the family members during the BC inquiry into missing and murdered Indigenous women and spoke with Gunnergy O'Sullivan over the phone about the launch of the inquiry into missing and murdered Indigenous women at the national level.
A national investigation to find out why all of our women and children are victims of not just missing and murdered, but children in care, in the institutions. And of course, it boils down to systemic issues, because for the First Nations rearview mirror, these issues didn't exist prior to contact. So there's something fundamentally wrong. And I'm really proud and very, very glad and positive to hear that the women and the families and all of the people involved are initiating this process.
Gladys Reddick, organizer of Walk for Justice, was in Ottawa when the inquiry was announced on Thursday, December 10th, and spoke to the importance of prioritizing the voices and needs of families and grassroots organizers.
Bernadette Smith from Winnipeg also had a chance to speak, and one of the chiefs stepped aside so that she could speak on behalf of us families in regards to having us involved directly with the process.
Well, this,
and I have a little bit of hope that they're actually listening to that, because I was watching the consensus of the room and everybody was shaking their head, and I think that they know that we're right.
Bernie Williams, who is also an organizer of Walk for Justice, reiterated the importance of prioritizing the families.
But, you know, what I want to see out of it is I would like to see that these, you know, as yourself too, you know, it should be really, really inclusive and for the families to be, you know, having their say. You know, it's taken so long.
Thank you to Gunnergy O'Sullivan of Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO, for the audio used in that report.
In commemoration of the Montreal Massacre that happened on December 6, 1989, at the École Polytechnique in Montreal, CKUT's Off the Hour hosted a panel discussion to analyze the event once again and the impact it had on the Canadian feminist movement and gun control laws. The panel discussed what has changed in the last 26 years, the role of men in combating patriarchy, and the militarization and glorification of violence that perpetuates gun violence. Here is an excerpt from the panel discussion.
Tonight's panel is devoted to the 26th anniversary of the Montreal Massacre. We remember the tragic event that occurred in École Polytechnique on December 6, 1989, when 25-year-old Marc Le Pen murdered 14 female engineering students, calling them a bunch of feminists and blaming them for ruining his life. The massacre has been an important marker in Canadian history, as it proved that gendered violence is far from disappearing and made governments think about reframing gun control laws.
We hope to connect the dots today with the help of our wonderful speakers. Maureen Bradley, a former Montrealer Concordia alumni, filmmaker, and associate professor from the University of Victoria.
We'll also be speaking with Rosemary Wally, who's been active in the struggle of women's rights, anti-racist groups, and peace groups. She has been a community radio programmer for many years and is on the board of the Center for Gender Advocacy.
And our final speaker is Kevin Bowles, who works as a community engagement manager for the White Ribbon Campaign in Toronto, which aims to empower men and boys to take a stand against violence against women and girls.
In 2012, a survey by Canadian Women's Foundation revealed that 67% of all Canadians say they know personally at least one woman who has been sexually or physically assaulted. What do we make out of that? What kind of changes have you seen happening throughout the years? Maureen?
I think in Canada, we've become, I guess, more attuned to the discussion. We're more open to talking about it. There's not quite as much hostility toward it in public discourse. Yet, you know, violence against women and children still persists. It's still a serious challenge for us.
You know, when I go out to work with engaging men and boys in the prevention of violence against women and girls, what I see are young men willing to come forward and stand up and say something when they see things like rape culture happening. You know, but it is a big journey, and I do still see resistance out there that we have a real problem here.
So there is still, as far as I can see, systemic sexism. I know at the time of the massacre, they were McGill only had 4% of the students were women in the hard sciences, in the physics at that time. And there were certainly questions in those days of whether this was an act of violence against women. And those of us that identified that right away were somewhat ridiculed.
Just to continue off of that, so one of the reasons actually those women were targeted was because they were engineering students, right, and were seen as trying to enter the traditionally male-dominated fields. And in work and even in life, the idea of being feminine is often seen negatively, and the femininity found even in trans, gay, and straight men can be perceived as a weakness. So White Ribbon was set up in response to the Montreal massacre in order to combat this ideology and show that feminist issues are issues for everyone. Kevin, do you think these perceptions are changing in modern society?
Yeah, I think the perceptions are gradually shifting, but you know, rooted in all of, you know, the hatred of women and the sexism and the homophobia is, I would have to say, a fundamental lack of willingness on the part of men to become more self-aware, to look at themselves, and to do some work around emotions. And I think that is gradually shifting. And when we see this sort of toxic and harmful masculinity shift, I believe then we're going to see a bit of a shift in violence against women.
Patriarchy, and that's what we're talking about, it isn't good for men either.
No.
It doesn't serve anybody, except, of course, the corporate sector and the arms traders and the fossil fuel people. But it doesn't serve the ordinary people. It doesn't help humanity in any way.
So we've talked a bit about gender, and the other thing that came out of the Montreal massacre was gun control. In the wake of the Montreal massacre, initiatives such as the Coalition for Gun Control were formed to support strategies to reduce gun death, injury and crime. And people in support of tightening gun controls in Canada use the massacre to, like, push for government action.
What do you think the connection is between Canada's military spending, which is $20 billion per year, and guns and violence in the hands of the individual? Do you think those things are connected?
Well, I think, you know, one thing I'll say, yes, of course I think they're connected. It's just a massive amount of money, isn't it? Sure, it's access to guns, but it's got to be something more than that. It's this glorification of militarization.
That was an excerpt from a panel discussion hosted by CKUT in Montreal on the 26th anniversary of the Montreal Massacre, hosted by CKUT's Rose Woolhouse, Katarina Gordichuk, and Emily Enhorning.
GroundWire's Carly Forbes brings us live coverage of community members protesting arbitrary status checks and racial profiling at Toronto Police Headquarters.
No justice!
No peace!
No justice!
No peace!
No racist!
No peace!
On December 17th, No One is Illegal Toronto organized a rally at Toronto Police Headquarters, protesting the practice of police calling the Canadian Border Services Agency to check the status of people.
Compared to the vast majority of people who are arbitrarily status checked, we found that only 7% of people reported that the CBSA actually had immigration warrants out in their name. This means that the Toronto Police are actively and willingly going out of their way to do the work of federal immigration enforcement. Not only is it not their job to enforce federal immigration law, which is administrative and not criminal, I'll be clear on that, it is not a crime to be undocumented in Toronto. This is in direct violation of Toronto's sanctuary city policies and is putting hundreds of thousands of Torontonians at risk. After much pressure from allied communities and organizations, City Hall passed additional motions last week reaffirming that the police must expand their policies to a full don't ask, don't tell. They already did this 2 years ago, but because of continued resistance by the Toronto Police, they're having to reaffirm the sanctuary city policies. These motions must be taken seriously. We must be taken seriously. The Toronto Police must be accountable to Torontonians. And so we're here today to say enough is enough. It's been 2 years since Toronto was declared a sanctuary city, and it's time for the Toronto Police to get their act together. They simply cannot keep resisting the mandate given to them by the City Council. They must stop the dishonesty around the practices of racial profiling and stop status checks. We are here today to remind the police that they are being watched. No more status checks in a sanctuary city. Thank you.
Nigel Barif, president of Urban Alliance of Race Relations, also spoke at the rally.
It is our position that the practice of randomly stopping individuals and collecting their information in a police database, like police checking the immigration status of those they stop based on racial profiling, is an example of systemic discrimination and racism in our society, a practice which particularly targets people of color and has led to individuals to lose employment and educational opportunities, these opportunities, interactions with the police appearing under police record checks. It's institutionalized and justified the criminalization of African-Canadian community, has eroded individuals and communities' collective sense of security, and has detrimentally impacted African-Canadians' sense of human dignity, and has created a chilling effect on a community's engagement with the legal system. The practice is arbitrary, unreasonable, and discriminatory, and must end.
Ellie, from the Network of Elimination of Police Violence, spoke to the importance of allyship within the fight to end police violence.
I just think it's really important to think about building solidarity together. So when we're talking about this, we have to think about who the police approach. We have to call them out for things like this and be present in these spaces all the time. We do not let them get away with this. We do not let them get away with policing young, black, immigrant youth. We do not let them get away with policing sex workers, harassing sex workers. We do not let them get away with that, and we do not leave the fight up to those being policed, up to those being oppressed by these institutions. Because when we come together in these communities, when we come together unified, we have more power than these people. We have more power than these people.
Now it's time for GroundWare's Community Radio Report, which features a short excerpt from a longer audio documentary called Healing Hands. Healing Hands was recorded by Francella Fialos of CKCU in Ottawa with the support of the AMARC Global Fund. It's part of a series of radio documentaries that mark this year's 16 Days of Activism Against Gender Violence. The 16 Days of Activism Against Gender Violence is an international campaign that stretches from November 25th to December 10th every year. It begins on the International Day Against Violence Against Women and symbolically links several other important dates which focus attention on gender-based violence in Canada and around the world. The subject of Healing Hands is the ongoing tragedy of missing and murdered Indigenous women in Canada and the grassroots mobilization done by women to raise awareness in their communities. Hey, 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 hey
because when my mother died, I mean, it was something for me, because even her case today, I fight for her, because when she died, like, she got struck and killed by the police, so it was like, they said, oh, your mother died because she was a drunken Indian and not, you know, not because she was a beautiful grandmother or anything like this.
That was Bridget Tolley, an Algonquin woman from the Kitiganzibi Ashnabeg in Quebec, Canada. Her mother, Gladys, was struck and killed by a police car in October 2001. Bridget is a committed activist in the movement to end violence and the disappearances and murders of Aboriginal women and girls. She's also active in social justice causes related to police violence, First Nations education, housing, and child welfare. Here's Fran Salafialos with more from her conversation with Bridget Tolley.
Bridget Tolley says she can remember exactly how her mother Gladys was killed, and 12 years ago to the day, Tolley says nothing has been done about it. Tolley has spent close to 3 years helping other First Nations women seek justice for their lost loved ones. Since 2010, families of Sisters in Spirit marched to Parliament Hill to grieve and to heal. Tolley says the march to Parliament is done with her mother in mind.
I wanted to find a way to bring her inside Parliament, and I didn't know how to do that. And I knew I was able to bring her outside and to figure out a way to try and get her inside Parliament. So I figured the best way to start was to bring her to the steps of the people that were trying to forget about her.
If you want to listen to this and other audio documentaries created to mark this year's 16 Days of Activism Against Gender Violence, you can go to AMARC's website at www.amarc.org.
Just heard Crossing the Pacific by Vancouver musician and composer Neelamjit Dhillon.
That's it for this edition of Groundwire, produced by volunteers at Kootenai Co-op Radio CJLY on Sinaik's traditional territory in Nelson, BC. This week's headlines were written by Carly Forbes and Catherine Fisher. We also thank Ome Salmarahemtula, Francella Fialos, Gennarji O'Sullivan, Matt Willish, CKUT, Off the Hour, the Red Eye News Collective, and Carly Forbes.
Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station, on the Rabble Podcast Network, or download at groundwire.ncra.ca.